Afternoon, a high of 53. Sunny and seasonal on Sunday, a high of 59. Right now, 37 degrees, Racine, 38 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. On today's morning show, we're going to be exploring a very intriguing story indeed. The story is of the creation of AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, and in particular, the crafting of what is known as the Big Book, which sets out in at least many aspects what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about. The author of the book at hand, writing the Big Book, The Creation of AA, is a gentleman by the name of William Schaberg, a scholar and rare book dealer, who has explored the creation of a number of different important works. And this is his most recent investigation, and a project that has taken him a number of years. And he has endeavored to sort out fact from fiction and maybe take a closer look at certain myth that has sprung up around the crafting of this really important work, which, of course, led very directly to the creation of Alcoholics Anonymous and its establishment as a very powerful force. And it is something that has affected tremendously the lives of all kinds of people dealing with alcoholism. For all that I have ever heard about Alcoholics Anonymous, much of this story of its earliest days and the crafting of this canonical work has something I've never known anything at all about. So I'm so pleased that this book has now appeared, published by CRP. Again, it's titled Writing the Big Book, The Creation of AA. And William Schaberg, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you for inviting me, Greg.
Ahead of us talking specifically about this book, I would love to know a little bit more about your professional life and what has led you to explore the kind of things that you have as both a scholar and rare book dealer. And be sure to tell us along the way where all of this began for you.
Thank you for the opportunity. I'm a rare book dealer. I specialize primarily in philosophical first editions, although I get into other things at times, AA materials being one of those things. Several years ago, I bought, before the Big Book was actually published in April of 1939, 2 months before, they had a multilith copy, an offset printed copy of the book that was circulated for comments, suggestions, and edits. And I bought a copy of that multilith printing at auction. And, of course, as a rare book dealer, I was curious to know how rare it was, how many copies had been printed. The things that had been published that I could access, secondary sources, said 100, 200, 300, 400 copies, and nobody was certain. So I finally got permission to go to the Alcoholics Anonymous archives in New York City. I was looking for the invoice for the printing of that book. I knew it cost $165. I just didn't know how many copies there were. I never found the invoice, but I found more and more fabulously interesting information about how the book got put together. And as I back the story temporally back from the printing of the book in 39 to its first the first time anybody said, hey, we should write a book, which was October of 1937, I found the story just compelling and absolutely fascinating.
Hmm. It is, according to your notes, a project that involved 11 years of research. Before we dig into any specifics at all, just talk for a moment about that span of time and just in general, why it has been a project that took that amount of time to ultimately take shape.
Well, first of all, there were a number, there was a tremendous amount of material in the archives. I ended up looking at every piece of paper that, for instance, the General Service Office of Alcoholics Anonymous has in their archives for 1937, 1938, and the first 6 months of 1939. Similarly, at the archives at Stepping Stones, which was the founder of AA, Bill Wilson's house in Westchester. But what was most, what drove a lot of the time it took was that neither of those archives make copies of things. So I had to go in and type up page by page, word by word, every word that was on all of those documents.
Wow.
And then take them back home and try and collate the various sources that I had with those documents and to put them all together. I was researching for 4 years before I started writing. So the last 7 years of my research, I was writing. And, you know, very interestingly, every so often I'd stumble over something that would make me have to go back and rewrite whatever I had written in Chapter 3, for instance, when I was working on Chapter 9, because I found some new document that I hadn't been aware of earlier.
Hmm. And I think this is probably an important point of clarification. I am assuming that you did not come to this task and to this question with any kind of history yourself with Alcoholics Anonymous, that you came to this quest as a rare book dealer and really curious about the genesis of this important book, which is at the heart of the creation of Alcoholics Anonymous. Am I correct in that? And if indeed I'm correct, what kind of impact do you think that has had on this project, the fact that you have come to this research and to this project, in a sense, as an outsider to the world of Alcoholics Anonymous?
Well, I'm not a complete outsider, Greg. I have a number of friends and even a couple of relatives who are Alcoholics Anonymous members. So I'm familiar with how it operates in their lives, and I've heard a number of stories from them when they talk about what they know about early Alcoholics Anonymous history. Certainly that fueled the fact that I would stumble over things that quite frankly, contradicted what I had been told by people that I knew in AA. And that drove me even deeper into the research. I'm not really sure what the impact of the book will be. I mean, the first chapter of the book is called entitled Challenging the Creation Myths. And quite frankly, there's a little bit of challenge in each of the 30 chapters that follow. People get very, very attached to some of the stories that have been told. He's been around for 80 years now. The book has been around for 80 years now. And they get very attached to those stories. I'm not quite sure what the reaction is going to be when they confront a different story that's backed up by primary document research.
Right. In fact, you write early in the book, however uncomfortable this may be for some devoted AA readers, what follows here is definitely much closer to what really happened than to many of these later more fantastic stories. So you have, in a sense, set about to write a book that you are all but certain will be received with at least a little bit of discomfort.
A little bit of discomfort. And it's not so different from Well, it is a bit different. But, you know, my first book was about Nietzsche, the German philosopher, his publication history. Similar kind of thing. I bought a Nietzsche first edition, and then I bought something that nobody could tell me if it was a first or a second edition. And I started doing research and ended up spending 5 years doing research and writing that book on Nietzsche's publication history. And in many ways, it contradicted the stories that had been put into the general historical understanding of Nietzsche and his writing by his sister, who took care of him after he became insane in 1889, up to his death in 1900. And his sister Elizabeth was a pathological liar, and she told all kinds of stories that weren't true. So my research in that book also was one of challenging a lot of those myths about Nietzsche.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with William H. Schaberg and talking about his most recent book, which is titled Writing the Big Book, The Creation of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this book is really, in a sense, both the story of how Alcoholics Anonymous was created back in the 1930s and about the way in which the important so-called Big Book came together and was ultimately published in 1939. So this would be an anniversary year for this book, which was originally titled Alcoholics Anonymous, The Story of How Many Thousands of Men and Women Have Recovered from Alcoholism. You tell us in this first chapter that the early history of Alcoholics Anonymous and the story behind the publication of this book can be best explored by looking at the writings and statements of four important people in the early history of AA. I wonder if you would tell our listeners about these four people and the respective roles that they played in the creation of Alcoholics Anonymous and or why they are important in terms of helping us understand that story better.
Well, the three most important people who left records of what they said happened in the early years of AA were, of course, the founder, Bill Wilson. He spoke repeatedly about early AA history right up until his death in 1971. One of the early men who got sober, Jim Burwell, he was commonly referred to as the New York atheist. He got sober in 1938, and he was profoundly atheistic and not shy about saying anything about that. In the late 40s, Jim gave a talk and then formalized it into a written document that he circulated on what he called the Evolution of Alcoholics Anonymous. Bill was inaccurate because he was a great storyteller, and he was really a salesman. He wasn't trying to do anything that was historically accurate detail by detail. Bill had a message of recovery that he wanted to convince people to adopt so that they could stop drinking and lead fruitful lives. So the fact that his stories weren't historically accurate don't bother me at all. It wasn't his project to be a historian. Jim, on the other hand, was in fact striving to be a historian, And he was just wildly inaccurate in a bunch of the things he said. And many of those things have gotten into the stream of what gets said about early AA history. Probably the next most important person would be Ruth Hock. Ruth Hock was secretary to Hank Parkhurst, Bill Wilson's right-hand man in New York City. And she was the one that Bill dictated most of the book to. She would type as he dictated. And then after the fact, especially when Bill was trying to write his history of Alcoholics Anonymous in the mid-50s, there's a number of letters between Bill and Ruth where he asks her questions about particular details and asks her opinion on things that other people have said, were they true or not. So those three people are all the major sources for things that were said after the fact, and there's varying degrees of unreliability to all three of those people's memories. Ruth claims to have a very terrible memory, most especially for dates, and that's proven by the exchange of letters they had in the mid-50s. as I said, Burwell was just notoriously bad on fact after fact after fact. And Bill Wilson wasn't even trying to be a historian. So trying to base a history of early Alcoholics Anonymous on those three people is just a dream. It's just not going to happen. You need to go back to and do primary document research, which
right,
I've done.
And not just rely on their recollections or their accounts of how things happened. And then there's a fourth person you mentioned at this point of the chapter as well, someone by the name of Ebbe Thatcher. Just quickly explain his role in all of this.
Ebbe Thatcher was the man who originally brought the message of recovery to Bill Wilson. They were friends. They had been friends in the past. Ebbe got sober through the Oxford group. And one of the things those people did was to try and spread the message. So Ebbe made a visit to Bill Wilson and told him that he had stopped drinking, shocking Wilson, and told Wilson that he had done it because he got religion. Bill Wilson told the story of Ebbe's visit in his story, what they call Bill's story. It's the first chapter in the book Alcoholics Anonymous as it was published in 1939. He talks about Ebbe coming, calling him on the phone and coming by and sitting down at the kitchen table with him one-on-one and telling him he's got religion and he's sober, he's not drinking anymore, and offering that solution to Bill. And Bill being shocked by that and thinking maybe he could use that, but he kept drinking. Wilson kept drinking at that point. Ebbe Thatcher told his own version of that story in the early and mid-50s a number of times. On one occasion with Wilson actually present, and those are recorded talks that are available through the archives. And his version of that story is just completely different. He calls a couple of days ahead. He doesn't get Wilson on the phone. He gets Lois, Bill's wife, on the phone. When he shows up, actually nobody's there. And they have dinner. He has dinner with Lois and the woman who rents the top floor of the brownstone that they live in. And afterwards, they all go up to the second floor parlor, and Lois says to Ebbe, "So, Ebbe, why don't you tell us what's happening?" And Ebbe tells the story about how he got sober with the Oxford group. Wilson walks him to the subway, puts his arm around him, and says, "Boy, I don't know what it is you got, kid, but I could sure use some of that." Now, Ebbe's version is one that has, you know, all the messy details in it. You know, when Bill Wilson told the story, he simplified it just down to bare bones. And the reason Wilson took it down to the bare bones, why his story doesn't have any of those details that we find in Ebbe Thatcher's story, is that Wilson was trying to deliver a message. And the message he was trying to deliver was one of the primary beliefs and foundational beliefs of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is that the message of recovery can best be delivered when one alcoholic talks to another alcoholic. So the story that Bill told about Ebbe's visit took out all the irrelevant details and boiled it down to a scene in which two men are sitting across a kitchen table, one from the other, and one of them is sober and delivering that message of recovery to one who's drinking.
So the simplicity of that encounter was a very important part of that story, and that needed to be, in a sense, the heart and soul of the story.
And that's what Wilson was doing, you know.
Right.
There's these wonderful quotes out of the book Passed It On, which is one of the conference-approved pieces of literature for Alcoholics Anonymous. And the author says things like, Wilson was never reluctant to stretch a fact for the sake of emphasis, and that he often spoke in metaphor rather than relating events as they actually happened, and that he was never likely to pass up the opportunity to deliver a parable when he thought it could do some good. Bill spoke in parables and myths. He was trying to deliver a vision of sobriety that people could understand and comprehend quickly and easily and hopefully reach out and grasp onto.
Right. I love the way you describe this in explaining how Bill Wilson was, in your words, a consummate storyteller. You write, his stories were almost always liberal simplifications of the facts. On one level, this is understandable. Facts are messy things, and they beg to be tidied up so that people can make sense of the story being told without having to travel down too many distracting byways. A good story needs to be simple, straightforward, and dramatic. Bill Wilson was a master at this. But I want you to talk about another aspect of the way in which Bill Wilson liked to craft his stories and in a sense, do engage in this myth-making. And that is that in many cases, the stories that he would tell would be shaped in such a way to deflect attention away from himself. And I found this fascinating because I think in so many cases, when someone is engaged in this kind of storytelling or myth-making, it tends to be the opposite. So often our inclination is to shape a story in such a way that we're the central figure and maybe the central hero. And it sounds like, at least in many instances, Bill Wilson had exactly the opposite intention. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes. Well, Bill had a problem that he was well aware of. He realized that he had an ego. He was at one time, rather than calling the movement Alcoholics Anonymous, he was thinking of calling it the BW movement. And that quickly got shot down by the troops in New York City. But what happened early on, and most especially throughout the 40s and into the 50s, was that Wilson became just this revered figure because people who had gotten sober in Alcoholics Anonymous would look at him and say, "That's the man who saved my life. Without him, I'd be a dead man." And he was just elevated to this place where he was just idealized and idolized, and he really fought very, very hard against that. One of the things he started doing in the mid-40s was disclaiming the fact that he was the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous. He was a co-founder, and Dr. Bob Smith was a co-founder. The first time that was mentioned was in 1945 that I can find. And later, Sam Shoemaker, who ran the Oxford Group in New York, was a co-founder. William James, the psychologist, philosopher who wrote The Varieties of Religious Experience, was a co-founder. It just went on and on and on. He kept spreading around the co-founder title in an attempt to deflect the centrality of his importance in the work, because it just was a really problem for him and for his ego. He also did this thing about, he talked about how 100 men wrote the book. Now, certainly, the book was based on the experience of the first 100 men, if there was 100 men. I think that's a stretch, but it was really, really based on Bill Wilson's experience of getting sober himself. That doesn't make a good story. That's not a great salesman's pitch to say, "This is how I got sober. Why don't you try it?" Wilson talked about, "This is how we got sober. This is how this has worked for 100 people. You should try this. It really does work."
Right.
So he needed to take himself out of the center of that story and spread the wealth around elsewhere for a number of reasons. But I think his primary motive was to rein in his own ego when people were just stroking it all the time.
Right. And I think this is so crucial. I think it's really important to fully appreciate this. You write at one point, as AA grew and his contribution became more widely known, Wilson became increasingly aware of the need to curb his natural tendencies towards grandiosity and to somehow temper the constant adulation that increasingly came his way as the founder of the movement, as the man who saved my life. I think that's really, really important to acknowledge, because there are some people who are, in a sense, kind of naturally reticent and want to shrink away from the spotlight just because that's where they're most comfortable, away from the spotlight. And Bill Wilson was not such a person, from the sounds of it, and yet he understood the way in which the group he founded would benefit if he himself were not thrust into the spotlight in a way that might be, in a sense, counterproductive to the organization itself.
And counterproductive to his entire mission in life.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with William H. Schaberg, and we're talking about his book, Writing the Big Book, The Creation of AA. And William Schaberg is actually a scholar and rare books dealer, and his interest in this story sprang primarily upon when he was able to secure a copy of a very rare book indeed. That would be one of the first printings of this book with which Alcoholics Anonymous was launched in 1939, the so-called Big Book, officially titled Alcoholics Anonymous, The Story of How Many Thousands of Men and Women Have Recovered from Alcoholism. I don't think we've yet talked about Bill Wilson's own situation, his own struggles with alcohol. Tell us what you think is most important for us to know about this.
Well, Bill was what he called a real alcoholic. He drank heavily. He started drinking just at the beginning of the involvement of the U.S. in World War I. Bill went overseas, but before he went overseas with the U.S. Army, he was given his first drink of alcohol, and he liked it a lot. He spent the 1920s after the war. He was pretty much a stock speculator, an entrepreneur on Wall Street. He did a lot of drinking there. And he continued that right into the 30s. Bill Wilson got sober in December of 1934 after going on his third or perhaps his fourth trip to the famous drying out place in New York, Towns Hospital. At Towns Hospital, Bill had what he later described as a white light experience, where he had a spiritual, let's call it a mystical encounter with God, and from that point forward, he didn't drink. This is not to say that he wasn't thirsty or tempted to drink after that. There's a wonderful entry into Lois's diary from mid-June of 1938. This is right in the middle of this entire project that I address in my book. And she and Bill get into a fight, and he storms out of the house, and according to Lois, he's going out to drink. But instead of drinking, he went up to visit his friend Hank Parkhurst, who lived in New Jersey, and presumably spent the night there and cooled off. I just find that a fascinating story. I just can't imagine, you know, if Bill Wilson had had a drink in 1938, I think the entire project would have crashed and burned. And a lot of people who have gotten sober and who have lived very fruitful lives, millions and millions of people who have gotten sober and lived fruitful lives because of their with Alcoholics Anonymous, would in fact never have gotten sober if AA hadn't been there.
This might be a good time for us to talk about something we've already briefly mentioned, something known as the Oxford Group, which at some point in the book you describe as the soil from which AA germinated. Tell our listeners about the Oxford Group, when and where it was formed, and its relationship to the group that ultimately came to be known as Alcoholics Anonymous.
Sure. The Oxford Group was founded by Frank Buchman. I'm not sure of the exact foundation dates. I would guess sometime around the First World War time. It was a back-to-basics Christianity movement. They wanted to go back to first-century Christianity before all the doctrinal stuff came out. They wanted to go back to the foundational idea of, by this shall they know that you are my disciples, that you love one another. And it was primarily, not exclusively, primarily an Episcopalian movement. And the center of that in the United States was a church in New York City run by Sam Shoemaker. Abby Thatcher, the man who came down and delivered the message of recovery to Bill Wilson, got sobered up by three men who helped him out of a legal jam in Vermont and then brought him down to New York and they were all Oxford Group members, and he got sober in the Oxford Group. Similarly, the second center of Alcoholics Anonymous activity throughout this period was in Akron, Ohio, where Dr. Bob Smith was. And Dr. Bob Smith was deeply involved in the Oxford Group. The meetings that they had in their house at this time, I mean, before the book was published, there was only two meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in the world. One was held on Tuesday night in Brooklyn, and the other was held on Wednesday night in Akron. And the Akron meeting, half the people there were Oxford Group members who weren't drunks at all. So the flavor and the texture of that meeting was very, very different from meetings that were held 10 years later, for instance, even 5 years later. Bill broke with the Oxford Group in May or April of 1937, and quite frankly, having broken with the Oxford Group, all of a sudden it became very clear to Wilson, and I think to his right-hand man, Hank Parkhurst, that now that they were untethered from the Oxford Group, it was time for them to form their own identity and to form their own movement, if you will. I think somewhere in the book I talk about that moment as being one as a crisis in leadership and in organization. So once Wilson broke from the Oxford Group, it led almost directly a couple of months later to this idea that they should write a book and circulate their ideas and their solution, their what they called at that time their cure for alcoholism.
Right. As we read about the Oxford Group, we see some intriguing similarities with what, of course, eventually has emerged as Alcoholics Anonymous, including one of the most intriguing things is four central tenets of the Oxford Group and in terms of what they believed was absolutely essential for someone to make a full and complete recovery from alcoholism: absolute honesty, absolute purity, absolute unselfishness, absolute love. So what was Bill Wilson's problem with that, or with the Oxford Group and the way that they conducted themselves? Why did he feel the need to break away and begin, in a sense, something new?
Well, Bill had a real problem with absolutes in general. Bill Wilson was not a dogmatic man in any sense. What he was a pragmatist. He was just such a fabulous example of American pragmatism. What he was interested in was what worked, what helped people stay sober, and he complained in the mid-40s. There's a wonderful letter where somebody asked him why he broke with the Oxford Group, and he lists seven or eight different things. But most especially, he talks about these absolutes and the fact that he said the drunks just weren't interested in getting that well that quickly. What they wanted to do was to stop drinking, and it got in the way. It put people off so that people would show up at meetings and then never come back again. And Wilson was not interested in that. He was interested in what worked. He was a William James guy, an American pragmatist.
Interesting. So we have a group that is being created, and at some point there is something that comes to be known as a grand plan for how this organization can be built and share its important message with the wider world. And there were three components created in this grand plan, only one of which involved the writing of a book, perhaps a guidebook of sorts. And, of course, that's what we'll get to in just a moment. But explain what this complete grand plan was, and in particular, these two tenets that ultimately fell away.
Yeah. I mentioned earlier that the first time they said, hey, we should write a book, was in October of 1937. That was said in a meeting, something like a summit meeting or a coming together of people from New York and people in Akron in October of 1937. And Wilson goes out to Akron, and he proposes to Dr. Bob Smith that that now that he's left the Oxford group, now that they need an organization, now that they need some sort of formulation of their mission, they need three essential elements to spread this word. They decide, we've got 40 people sober, and we have found a cure for alcoholism, so now it's time to let the rest of the world know about this. And the three components they came up with, Bill Wilson came up with, was paid missionaries to go from town to town setting up meetings and little cells and groups of recovering alcoholics, a string of hospitals that were alcoholic hospitals that were going to be established all across the country. You got to remember that this is 1937, and this sort of idea has just been entering the commercial market. Companies like A&P supermarkets were coming up and spreading across the country. The whole mom-pop thing was going out. So Wilson was looking for a string of AA hospitals. And the third element he proposed was the book. Now, they had a vote, supposedly, in Akron. All the stories told about that are very, very tenuous, as I mention in my book and detail some of the tenuousness. But supposedly, by the slenderest of margins, a vote was taken in Akron, and Bill Wilson was authorized to go back to New York City to raise the money for a string of hospitals, for paid missionaries, and for a book. And Wilson did. He went back to New York and tried to start raising money. He had no luck whatsoever raising the money.
Right. Among the interesting events at this time is a meeting that ends up occurring with none other than John D. Rockefeller Jr., one of the richest men, if not the richest man in the world at the time. But that ultimately does not result in the amount of money they were sort of hoping for. Can I ask you real quick about something I have in my notes here about Lois Smith's diary from this period, with some pages that are torn out that might have helped answer some of the questions about this period in time? That's certainly an intriguing mystery. Remind me what that is all about.
Now, that would be Lois Wilson's diary, Bill Wilson's wife.
Yes.
She kept diaries, and they were very, they've got, the diaries are preserved in the Stepping Stones archive in Katona, New York. They're very, very, very different. 1937 is one of those years where it's very spotty. There's many days she writes absolutely nothing in her diary, and when she makes entries, they're typically pretty short. But right around the time of this trip out to Akron, where they count noses and decide that they need to have these three important initiatives to spread the word, there's a couple of entries just before they leave, and all kinds of details. Bill Rudell and his wife, Kathleen, drive down and pick us up in Brooklyn, and we drive up to here, and we spend the night there. Then we go on, and we pick up Fitz Mayo, who comes up from Maryland, and then we go to Akron, and we stay there. Boom. There's like five pages missing after that, which would have covered exactly what happened during this summit meeting, if you will, in Akron, where all these important decisions were made. Five, maybe six pages missing. And then the next page that's not missing, she says, oh, and Sterling Parker and his wife drove us back to New Jersey, and then we had breakfast here, and then we got on the subway and went back home. And so those pages are missing. Actually, the 1937 diary has 72 pages, I believe, that have been torn out, and I have no idea what that's all about. I'm really not that interested in the other 60 plus, but I would really, really love to know what happened in Akron and what she wrote in those things that she felt that they should be taken out. And Lois did take those out. Those pages were missing. They're known to have been missing before she died.
Interesting. Well, ultimately, of course, as we've just said, the grand plan is pared down. There will not be missionaries. There will not be these alcoholic hospitals. But there will be a guidebook, a so-called book of experience that will be created to help spread the word about the good that can be accomplished, how lives can be changed through Alcoholics Anonymous. It is absolutely fascinating to read of what exists from the very earliest efforts of Bill Wilson to craft what ultimately becomes the so-called Big Book. In fact, you tell us that a few pages from his very first manuscript still exist. Tell our listeners what one sees when you examine some of those first manuscript pages.
Well, the first attempt he made to write is just a handwritten 7 or 8 pages that just peters out. He never finishes that. He gets off track with the story. He then types up a very long. Bill was shooting for about a 5,000-word chapter, and his first real long attempt to tell his own story is like 12,500 words long, and he still hasn't gotten out of Towns Hospital. So that was a problem. His third attempt was closer to the story that appears in the book today, although it's been edited down a couple of times. The second story he wrote after his own story was the chapter called There Is a Solution. And that's also interesting to read in its original version and compare it to what was published both in the Multilit copy of February of 1939 and the book itself when it was published in April of 1939. The original version of There Is a Solution has been cut for. I don't remember the exact number off the top of my head, but it's in the book. I think somewhere between 35 and 40% of the text has been cut. So reading that original version, I think, makes for fascinating reading. But Wilson was always very, very clear there and in his later writings about what his project was, what his message was. And my understanding of the basic message of Alcoholics Anonymous is twofold. I think there's two basic points that encapsulate everything else that's important about Alcoholics Anonymous. Wilson said that the real alcoholic is powerless over the first drink. That means a man or woman who's a real alcoholic and has no alcohol in their body, sooner or later, is going to pick up a drink no matter what. And that's because, Wilson said, they have this strange mental twist. They have some sort of thing that he calls, at one point, he says, what can we call this but plain insanity, that we've got no booze in our body. We know the terrible things that happen when we drink. We've made promises to everybody, from our boss to our wife to our mother, and we still pick up the drink. We still pick up the drink because if you're a real alcoholic, you're powerless over the first drink. Oh, point two. No, there's something you can put between you and that first drink if you're a real alcoholic that will give it some distance and keep you away from that, and that's a vital spiritual experience. Now, Wilson had his own version of what constituted a vital spiritual experience. It was based on his own experience that kept him away from that first drink. But he did, in fact, always try to. Eventually, he got to the point where he had a more open and a more flexible idea of what constituted that vital spiritual experience. Interestingly, in the first version of There Is a Solution, it doesn't say vital spiritual experience. It says vital religious experience. But the toning down from religious to vital is one of the important things that happened over the next few months from the time that chapter was written in early June until the Multilith copy was printed the following February.
Right, and you tell us about Hank Parkhurst's his influence, among others, in terms of perhaps toning down certain elements involving religion. And it's also Hank Parkhurst who, I believe, coins the term the program.
The program and a number of other things. Parkhurst is just, most people in AA don't even know who Hank Parkhurst is, but he was Bill Wilson's right-hand man. He was the guy who, the first man Wilson got sober in New York City in late 1935 after he came home from Akron getting Dr. Bob sober. And they were just joined at the hip. And Hank Parkhurst is the guy who drove the book project. He was just on fire to get this book written and out there because he thought they were going to sell millions of copies and make a ton of money. That's where the money was going to come from eventually, the money they couldn't raise from rich philanthropist, they thought they were going to get it from the book. Hank certainly thought he was going to get it from the book. But Hank was always pushing Bill Wilson, lighting a fire under him to get this project off the ground and then finished. I'm fond of saying to people who have never heard of Hank Parker, you need to pay attention to this man. No Hank, no book.
Hmm. But, of course, Hank Parkhurst is the one who sadly began to drink again. And that is one of the reasons why his name is largely missing from many accounts of the creation of Alcoholics Anonymous. Am I remembering that correctly?
You are remembering. It was an uncomfortable fact for them to say this guy was the key guy in getting this fabulous book done. And, oh, yeah, 6 months after it was published, he was drinking. He never got sober again.
Right.
He just never got sober again. I just can't imagine how painful that must have been to Bill Wilson to have somebody he was so close to and so simpatico with go out and drink again. Right. I don't know how Wilson explained that to himself.
Hmm. And you do tell us that in some of these very, very first pages of manuscript, as Bill Wilson is first attempting to write this book, that we can see right there on the page how he had meticulously counted the number of words on each and every page. So, I mean, there is a very intense, meticulous care that he is taking. And no wonder it took so long and was such a difficult undertaking for him to ultimately finish this book.
Yes. Yeah, It was Parkhurst. Parkhurst told him that if he wrote two chapters, they would be able to take those two chapters and approach people with money and get contributions. And that didn't really happen. Those were written in late May and early June. The book project didn't get picked up again until the middle of September. And again, that was driven by another Hank Parkhurst idea. They were going to have an article written in This Week magazine. It was a Sunday supplement that was had a circulation of millions of copies. And they were going to have an article written. And in that article, they were going to say, if you would send us a dollar, we'll send you five chapters of the book, which is going to be published shortly. And so he had to push Wilson to start writing. He needed three more chapters. They only had two at that point.
Wow.
And once Wilson got started in September, mid-September of 1938, he continued and finished the book. The manuscript went to the first editor either on New Year's Eve or New Year's Day of 38-39.
Hmm. And your book, of course, ultimately chronicles the shaping of what came to be known as the Big Book, how those 12 steps evolved from four and underwent certain changes. And you even tell us the story of the origins of that famous phrase of Bill Wilson, God as we understand him, a very important expression in the AA lexicon. That and much more as we explore the ultimate crafting and release of this very, very important book, known as The Big Book, in your own book called Writing the Big Book, The Creation of AA, published by CRP, an endlessly fascinating book, the author William Shaberg. William Shaberg, I learned so much in reading your fascinating book, and I know many others will as they take it up. I thank you for the time you took to write it and the time you took to tell us about it today on The Morning Show. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Greg.
Next week, very busy for The Morning Show. Monday, I will be speaking with Dr. Ankur Desai, who is Reed Bryson Professor of Climate, People, and Environment at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's coming to UW-Parkside for their fifth annual Alumni Community Celebration for the Colleges of Natural and Health Sciences. On Tuesday, Nancy Tate, a Woodrow Wilson Visiting Fellow to Carthage, and head of the 2020 Women's Vote Centennial Initiative, a former leader of the League of Women Voters, speaking as the world celebrates the 100th anniversary of women finally gaining the right to vote here in the United States. on Wednesday, Neil Sharnick from Carthage's theater department talking about an interesting play they're about to do called The Handbook, based on a real-life experience of some NFL cheerleaders who sued the NFL. On Thursday, Michael Prudham, who is with the group Sleep in Heavenly Peace, they construct safe beds, comfortable beds for children in homes that otherwise do not have beds. And on